Welcome to It Takes a Village, a Gaggle podcast. Listen in as we dive into education topics, speak with industry leaders, and share the latest updates from Gaggle. My name is Paget Hetherington, and I'm the Vice President of Marketing here at Gaggle. This is our very first podcast, so I'm thrilled to be able to be talking with Dr. Keisha Ray today, who is now our first ever guest. A little bit about Keisha. Keisha is a strategic thinker and a proven leader in K-12 transformation. Her career includes designing technology within the Frist Art Museum and directing technology research through Vanderbilt University. Keisha was appointed as a turnaround agent by the Tennessee Commissioner of Education, and she established award-winning instructional technology programs that have been recognized by the U.S. Department of Education, as well as Harvard University. And there's just a few more things to say about Keisha, which is about her long list of awards that she's won. So I'm just going to pick a few of those because there's so many to list. For example, Dr. Ray was named 20 to Watch by the National School Board Association, Woman of the Year by the National Association of Professional Women, a top 10 EdTech leader by Tech and Learning, an ISTE Making It Happen recipient, and most recently, she was named a top 100 EdTech influencer by the EdTech Digest. Thank you very much, Keisha, for taking the time today to speak with me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for having me as your inaugural guest. I feel so privileged to be here.
So I'm honored now to have this opportunity to speak with Dr. Ray. We're going to dive into our conversation. Without further ado, I'm going to start the conversation off with a discussion about some of the challenges that we're facing, all of us in K-12 education, during these complex times. The pandemic has been a major disruptive force in education. So Keisha, how do you see education evolving post-pandemic? Another way to say that is, what do you see the new normal looking like, say in a year from now?
I don't know if anybody saw it, but I recently wrote an article for Tech and Learning on the new normal. And I kind of talked about what I thought the new normal would look like and the elements that would kind of carry through on the other side of COVID. And one of the things that I mentioned was a focus on wellness and health. I don't think we're ever going to have a time in the future where we don't try to really be a lot more considerate of how our students and teachers and administrators feel, and be more cognizant of the kind of the load that they're bearing in their works. In my personal past, I've had this push through mentality. And I think that that might be a little bit forgiven. I think it's going to be a new way of doing any kind of business, not just education. I just also did a webinar yesterday where I moderated it, and we talked about the quote new normal. And a statement that I made in kind of closing comments was, I really hope once a vaccine is distributed and, you know, Lord willing, everybody takes advantage of that, and we can put this pandemic in the rearview mirror, that we don't have this moment in time where we collect all the laptops and all the, you know, hotspots and put them in a closet somewhere. I really hope that we see this evolution in education as something very positive and very beneficial to students, to families, and to teachers, and that we can continue doing some of the effective practices that we've identified through this time. I wouldn't call anything a best practice because we haven't tested it through time, but I do think we've taken some best practices and applied them to the work that's having to take place now. And I think we're going to see that application is going to be able to stand the test of time. And a perfect example of that is blended learning.
Excellent. I mean, it's absolutely true that this whole concept of what we're going through right now, I mean, it's a completely disruptive environment. And oftentimes with a disruption of sorts, it moves the needle into a direction that a specific industry or a part of society hasn't been in before. So what you just described is, you know, possibly where we're going in the future, which I think, you know, there are so many difficult things we're facing, but that's a positive view. And it's nice to have a positive view of what's going on, right? So thank you for that.
I think so.
So what do you think would be the greatest challenge for district leaders this current semester?
Very good question. And one that I ask a lot of my district leaders that I work with. And, you know, it varies across districts. I just got a call this morning from a superintendent whose start of school was really, you know, well received. And then, you know, a month in, there's been a little bit of a shift, and she's not even sure what caused the shift, but now people want a different schedule and a different platform, and they don't realize the lift that it takes to do that work. So I think one of the greatest challenges is going to be leveling expectations and helping parents, students, teachers, community at large understand the limitations of a particular model or a particular technology, and also the kind of, you know, when you're working in an innovative space, like a startup, for example, you don't have everything figured out. You're kind of figuring stuff out as you go. And I think that's where a lot of districts are right now. I think they figured out as much as they can concretely figure out. But I think things are kind of ebbing and flowing, especially as we're coming up on the election. I think people are going to feel a little bit of tension, and they're going to have to react to that. So, you know, a lot of people say the digital divide is the greatest challenge. But I honestly think that that challenge doesn't belong to a school district. That belongs to a community. That it shouldn't be put upon a school district to solve for the digital divide in a particular community, because schools aren't the only ones that are dependent on the internet or device access. That lives with everybody. If you are on any kind of a WIC program, you have to get onto the internet to get your card reloaded. If you're in any kind of a work environment where you're an hourly employee, you probably have to clock in on your phone using your data. So it's not a school district challenge. I mean, we have it as a challenge, but the solution doesn't live with a school district. I think the solution for the digital divide lives with an entire community.
For the students themselves, you know, what would you consider to be, given all of that and given the times we're in right now, the biggest concern?
I mean, my biggest concern personally for students is the disruption that they've had in their entire kind of ecosystem. Their sports have been augmented in some fashion. The classes, the gymnastics or dance or cheer classes have been modified in some way. Their school has been changed in some way. If they go to church or any kind of faith-based service, that's been modified. And I'm not certain that they fully understand, even if they're high school students, what's going on and why these things are happening. And I think that that creates a little imbalance in them. I see it in my niece and nephew. I see it in my one-year-old, and she's not even in school. But she, when she goes to the store, when we take her once in a blue moon to the store and people are behind a shield, she's like, huh, she'll poke at the shield. She's like, what's that? Why? You know, it just doesn't, even to a one-year-old who's really never experienced society that much, that seems odd. So I think my biggest concern for students is just their kind of mental health and their ability to synthesize everything that's going on in their world and feel like they can survive it.
Right. Absolutely. That is key. And I think, student mental health has been a problem before the pandemic. And now it's,
Absolutely.
it's just exacerbated. So it's definitely
Yeah.
something that we all need to be really aware of. So I agree. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. And I want to talk a little bit more about you and your career, Keisha.
Oh,
And
okay.
so one of my first questions on that is, what was your favorite role when you were working in a district and why? Is that a tough one?
It is because I have so many favorite
Right.
roles. I loved being a teacher. I absolutely loved being a teacher, especially of middle grade students, which is typically not a grade span that people like to teach, but I love middle schoolers because they're quirky and fun, and they're seeing the world in a whole new way during their transition to adulthood, and it's super cool to be kind of in their space as they're visualizing their world. But probably my very favorite role when I was in the central office and responsible for federal programs and technology. So I was an assistant superintendent, and I was responsible for all the federal programming in the district, including CTE and IDEA. And I was responsible for all the technology in the district that was education focused, not the IT infrastructure, but the ed tech side of it. And that was a phenomenal role because when you're supporting schools with their federal funds, you get to help with school improvement plans. And so you're working in each and every school. We had over 200 schools, with how they're thinking about their school and designing the programs in their school. And then because I had that ed tech element, was able to introduce pieces of ed tech into that planning process. Have you thought of this? What do you think of this? What if you taught this curriculum this way? And so you could see over a course of time an evolution in their thinking and a greater adoption of more interactive technology tools that would really inspire kids learning and motivate teachers to, because it gave them data that they didn't have access previously. So I think I really enjoyed that. Plus, also in that role, I got to help them redesign learning environments and develop grant programs that schools could apply for. And so with my old principal hat and old teacher hat, I was like, wow, I wish I had this. And then I would just create a grant program that would enable a school to have access to a pot of money that could, do something magical in their
That's
school.
awesome. So really
So
empower.
I
Yeah,
loved
that's
it.
great. Based on that, what would you say is your all-time favorite career moment?
I think my very, very favorite career moment is when President Obama came. He did his State of the Union address. It was his last State of the Union address. And he flew from DC to Nashville to capstone that address with a focus on education. I also was one of the few, maybe even the only, that was invited to stay in the district. And I stayed another 7 years post that transformation. And the US Department of Ed, of course, knew that. And President called that out. And he said, this is what transformation looks like. This is how you improve a district. It is a partnership with the community. It is an adoration for a community. And it is recognizing the place a school district has in support of an entire community. And that was our entire approach. And getting that kind of recognition from the president is like better than getting proposed to. And I waited 10 years for
Totally get that that would be an all-time
that.
favorite career moment. Thank you for sharing that. You talk about Nashville. I know you're working now with some of the largest school districts in the country. And I wonder, can you share maybe with us some challenges that these large urban districts are facing at this current juncture?
I left the school district and I began a consulting career. And that consulting career has led me to working with several school districts around the country, but the two that I have probably worked with the most are New York City Department of Ed and Los Angeles Unified. And worked with each of them in kind of the, from March to today, I'm still working with them on what learning can look like in this time and space. And, you know, one of the things that probably every large urban district has, almost independent of the state that they're in, but it's certainly somewhat dependent, which is the relationship they have with the teachers union and negotiating the kind of terms of the contract or the terms of the MOU or whatever they call it in their respective districts. And that's been, I'm not going to say a challenge, but it's been something that has been a focus to make sure that there's a good understanding of what the teacher's role needs to morph into in this new normal, and how the teacher will kind of have a different set of duties because of the online aspect and the synchronous and asynchronous aspect of what he or she is doing right now. So I think that's something that large districts are, you know, they have to focus on. They have to focus on that clarity for their teachers. And then just the digital divide that we've already talked about. I mean, making sure that everybody has access to devices and has access to, you know, the internet. The cool in LA, they have a super cool tool that can tell them when a device boots up and connects to the internet that is a school-based device, they know. And if the device has a lag in connection, and they can check and see what's going on. Like, is there some kind of outage in the area? And they can, you know, they can even, you know, call and say, hey, are you having problems connecting to the internet? So they have gotten really down to the laptop level, so to speak, of connectivity with some of their data tools, which has been really cool to watch. And then in New York, we just opened this week with a small population. There's kind of an iterative approach to their opening, where this week they have a certain group of students coming, next week another group, and the following week another group. And I think the challenge that New York always has is scale and getting communication out to everyone in a way that they feel duly informed. I think everybody has done their level best, but I still see some teachers just trying to kind of figure out, in some of the groups that I'm in, just trying to figure out how to do this work and how to figure out where that communication was that we sent out and, you know, where they can find resources. But we have a lot of people trolling those sites and plugging information in, so hopefully they'll feel supported in no time at all.
Well, they're fortunate to have you helping them. So I'm glad to hear that that's part of what you're up to these days. That's excellent. Well, speaking of people that you've worked with, what about Gaggle?
You know, I used it when I was in district. We had Gaggle. It saved a lot of my kids. It helped me know, kind of have a pulse, so to speak, on how kids were interacting with different resources that I was making available to them. And it also helped me find out information that I would have never known. I had kids who ran away that we were able to recover very quickly before they could get too far. I had kids who were attempting suicide that we were able to save before they were able to literally jump off of a chair with a rope around their neck. So it has been a tremendous resource to me personally in my school district. And I love sharing what a great resource it is to schools today.
Okay, well, I'd like to shift now for a moment onto another topic, which is about being a woman leader in K-20 education. And I'm thinking, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about being an assistant superintendent, and you know, I wonder about things like the glass ceiling and how challenging it is for women to move up in the ranks, you know, in districts, in business, in education, and whether there's anything you can share with us along those lines.
Well, when I was president of ISTE, one of the opportunities that I had was to kind of create my passion project, a woman's leadership group. And for the years that I was president, we assembled these women from all over the world. So I had the female president or minister of education from Saudi Arabia. I had people who were in the ministry of women who were in the ministry of education in Australia, who had worked up to very high ranking positions, New Zealand, India. I had probably 80 to 100 women in this group worldwide. We would come together at ISTE every year. And I've tried to keep that kind of tribe of amazing females together and grow it. So when I transition to my consulting, I'm a ladies only consulting group. You know, one of my mentors is Kathy Hurley, who wrote a book called Real Women, Real Leaders. And she highlighted a whole lot of women. I happen to be one of them in that book that had broken through glass ceilings in some form or fashion in their careers. And they were chefs, they were financiers. I mean, just publishers, all kinds of ladies are in that that book. And she asked us to kind of highlight what our most challenging experience was when in higher ed. And it's really, really challenging in higher ed. As a matter of fact, one of my friends just became a president of a university. I'm so proud of her because she's not in her 40s yet, and she's already a president of a university. And she's following her dad's footsteps. He was a president of a university. But it's really hard in higher education to move in to high-ranking positions as a female unless you may have had to compromise somewhere along the way. That doesn't stand for all institutions, but for the institution I was at, there were people that passed over me. And I knew they hadn't done the research I'd done. I knew they didn't do the publications I had done. And I was just stunned at how that might have happened. I think there's still a double standard out there in some organizations and in some fields, some colleges, universities, probably school districts. Mm-hmm. RGB did a lot. There's so many women in the world who have done great stuff to move our cause forward. But I think a lot of time our cause gets pushed back because of other causes, which are just as important. Mm-hmm. We just have to keep the movement.
Keep it going. Absolutely. Keep it going.
And I'm starting a podcast, my friend. Yeah. I'm starting a podcast called Honor Roll. We're actually taping it today. And it's all ladies and ladies who are really leading in the education space. And I'll give you a teaser that Angela Meyer is our first guest.
Wow.
So she's so awesome. And Frances Gibson is going to be partnering with me on it. She's the former chief academic officer of Los Angeles Unified. And I think it's going to be a really great opportunity to lift the voices up of amazing, esteemed women. And hopefully mentor younger women or women who were going through things I was going through, trying to move up the ladder, trying to get equal pay,
right,
to inspire them that, people have come before you who have led the way, and you're not alone. That's what I want them all to feel as a result of that.
Well, I think your timing on that, it's great.
Okay. So thank you so much, Keisha, for taking the time today to speak with me on It Takes a Village, a Gaggle podcast, our first ever guest. We really appreciate you taking the time. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to future conversations.
Thank you. I appreciate it too. I love Gaggle, and I adore you and Jeff and a whole lot of other people on the Gaggle team. So I'm just super honored to be here.
I'll leave you listeners with this as our close for today's It Takes a Village podcast. To date, Gaggle has helped districts save thousands of student lives. This past school year alone, we were able to help districts save 927 students who were planning or actually attempting suicide. So far this academic year, Gaggle has helped districts save the lives of 183 students. This number has doubled from this time last year. Please join us again for another episode of It Takes a Village, a Gaggle podcast, and visit us at gaggle.net. Thank you for listening in.